And welcome to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now is Craig Stanford. He is a professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California and is the author of numerous books, including Planet Without Apes and The Last Tortoise, A Tale of Extinction in Our Lifetime. Now Stanford has penned a new book titled Cold-Blooded Murder, Reptiles and Amphibians on the Brink of Extinction. Craig, welcome to This Green Earth.
Nice to talk to you.
Before we discuss your latest book, which has a very intriguing title, by the way, we'd like to get to know the man behind the writing. So tell us why and when you first became interested in biological sciences.
Well, you know, I grew up as one of those nerdy science kids in a little town in New Jersey and catching, you know, snakes and frogs like a lot of kids do. And I then actually went into, for most of my career, the study of primates. So I worked with Jane Goodall for decades, lived with her in Africa for my work, studied chimpanzees, mountain gorillas. Most of my book writing early on and articles and grants were about that. Only later did I kind of decide one day, maybe like a late midlife crisis in an academic sense, that I would go back and also do the stuff that I grew up being really passionate about as a kid, which was to go back and study reptiles. I think my colleagues thought it was a little bit odd, I had recognition in the field I was in working with primates. But I reached out to some people and got a lot of warm reception from a biologist I had never met, inviting me to kind of get involved in the work that they do. And I found myself very quickly actually being deeply involved in not only research, but also conservation efforts to save some of the world's rarest reptiles and amphibians. And my particular interest has been turtles and tortoises. So I'm actually now the co-chair of IUCN's Turtle and Tortoise Specialist Group, which is a kind of an affiliated group to the United Nations. And we're 400 scientists who try to plot how to prevent these animals from going extinct in the near future. And it's very rewarding for me. It's a real passion project.
Well, it's a really wonderful path that you've been on. And obviously, Jane Goodall is beloved by many. And what a great experience to begin working in that realm and then turning your eyes back on something that it sounds like was a young passion of yours. And now you've written this new book, Cold-Blooded Murder, Reptiles and Amphibians on the Brink of Extinction. And I have to admit, okay, so I'm going to do a big admission here. So Komodo dragons are the creatures on Earth that I fear the most.
And you fear them? I thought you were going to say they're your spirit animal, which would be a little weird.
Yeah, they are not my spirit animal. I fear them the most, actually. And I have never encountered an actual Komodo dragon. What my fear stems from is being very close with encounters with monitor lizards in Singapore and skinks in Australia. And I have to say, when you look directly into a skink's eyes, that can instill a fear in you that I can't even explain.
Well, I just have to interrupt and say that skinks are little. Komodo dragons are big enough to be bona fide scary, of course, and they are dangerous. But skinks, you shouldn't be afraid of skinks.
Well, that's what everyone in Australia told me as well. But in talking with you, I'm hoping that I can lessen my bristle when I think about these creatures.
We'll work on that.
Let's do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I find it, and now that you bring that up, I find it fascinating because I do all this work with turtles and tortoises. But as a kid, I grew up, you know, with pythons in my bedroom and that kind of thing. So many people, of course, just despise snakes and are terrified of them also, just loathe them. But reptiles includes turtles and tortoises, pretty closely related, and everybody loves turtles and tortoises. So there's something about the body shape or some other aspect of them that repulses people on the one hand, and then turtles and tortoises are beloved on the other hand. So I find that kind of interesting. But what you said about Komodo dragons is kind of true. It's kind of rational in the sense that they're just overgrown monitor lizards. You know, they're the largest lizard on Earth. They're monitor lizards, and they are highly intelligent. We know from captive studies that they're one of the few reptiles who clearly recognize individual people, like their keepers.
Wow.
And they play with toys. They enjoy object play, which not many reptiles do. So yeah, everybody who's ever maintained them, some of the people in zoos who maintain them, always talk about they're very clear intelligence. And of course, an animal that's that big and potentially dangerous, just the bite and also the fact that they do have venom that they can conduct. You know, that combined with intelligence, that's a scary animal.
Yes, it seems like an animal that you would inherently fear, but the idea that they have recognition of faces, that they can play with toys, they have these characteristics that in some ways help bring us closer to them. But what are some of their other biological characteristics that make them unique?
Well, we should first say they are the largest lizard. So a big Komodo dragon, a big adult, could be 10, 11 feet long, including a very long tail. And they have an incredible sense of smell. So the first time I went to Komodo, I was accompanying a tour group. Actually, I'd taken my daughter along also as kind of a treat. We were traveling with this group of ecotourists, and I had been hired to, you know, give lectures for them. And people said they had heard that when you get to Komodo, they tie a goat out on a stake and the Komodo dragons come out of the hills and tear it apart,
Oh
which
boy.
is a very gruesome scene. And I assured them that was a thing in the past. In fact, that really was a thing that was done for tourists at one time. And it inspired that scene in Jurassic Park when the T-Rex comes out and grabs the goat from a stake.
Right.
So I assured my tourists, you're not going to see this. Don't worry. This has been banned for a long time for humane reasons. So we got to Komodo, and there was a government dignitary visiting that day who had asked that they please put the goats out.
Oh
And
my.
so they weren't live goats, but nevertheless, it was a really gruesome scene. And my daughter, who absolutely beforehand said, I don't want to see this, was so enthralled. It was just nature red in tooth and claw. And we all stood watching this scene of about maybe 20 dragons that came out of the hills in the forest because they can smell the goat from miles away. So when I mentioned the venom, we used to think that we've always known that the bite of a Komodo dragon is very bad. It's very likely leads to severe infection. But we now know it's not just because there is a large bacterial load in the mouth, which there probably is, but also because they have venom, that they're one of the very few venomous lizards that they can conduct. It's a weak venom, but it's venom they can conduct into an animal they bite. So for instance, on Komodo, there are a number of introduced animal species. They don't belong there, but they've been introduced by people. So water buffalo, deer. And if they bite a small buffalo in the leg, they can't bring the buffalo down when it's alive and kicking, but the venom causes the buffalo's blood pressure to drop dramatically. And so the buffalo wanders off and then is really unable to function, you know, within a short time. The dragon tracks it down because it has that incredible sense of smell. So yeah, they have a number of, you might call them Darwinian skill sets that serve them incredibly well. People always ask, of course, first question, why are they so big? Why on these, they're just two tiny islets in the Indonesian archipelago, and
Right.
why would they have these large lizards? And we think the reason is that as cold-blooded animals, and the book is called Cold-Blooded Murder for that reason, as cold-blooded animals, they can go for weeks and weeks without eating, which of course a warm-blooded animal like a deer or a wolf could never do that. They would starve to death. But a cold-blooded animal can tolerate that. They don't need to eat a lot. So they can live on tiny islands that don't have a lot of resources, meaning a lot of animal food, a lot of prey. And in the same way, the Galapagos, of course, and a lot of these oceanic tiny islands in the past, before we wiped the tortoises out, had giant tortoises. And they became very large. They evolved into large size, gigantic size. We think because on an island like that with very little food, the cold-blooded animals are able to hang on and even thrive in a place where other mammals, warm-blooded animals that browse grass and bushes, just can't live if there's a drought. And if for 6 months of the year they can't find anything to eat, they would, of course, starve. So there's kind of a rule. There are many exceptions to it, but we kind of see reptiles attaining sometimes gigantic size on islands. And in the same setting on islands, we see relatively few mammals, and those that are there sometimes are actually dwarfed. They've evolved into small size so that they can handle
Interesting.
the lack of resources.
Okay, so this is all very interesting. And you mentioned Jurassic Park. When you date a Komodo dragon and its evolution, where is it deriving from, and how long can you say that they've been in this particular body size.
Well, we have a tendency when we look at these animals, the reptiles, to think that they're kind of dinosaurian. And I mean, Komodo dragon, it's obvious why we think that, because they look so much like our reconstructions of what dinosaurs looked like. I'm always amazed when people look at tortoises and they just make this assumption that a Galapagos tortoise that weighs 400 pounds and kind of has that ET head and neck look is an ancient animal. This animal must be 100 years old or more, when in fact they attain that size and appearance very, very quickly. So in terms of their lifespan, they grow very quickly, as do Komodo dragons. But in terms of their evolutionary history, they are ancient, but it isn't really true that they're just modern dinosaurs. They came from a different evolutionary route. Dinosaurs and reptiles are quite different animals with different ancestries, unless you go really, really, really far back. But for the last 100 plus million years, they've been on their own path. And of course, we don't have dinosaurs around today, although some people would argue that birds are another evolutionary branch of the original dinosaur lineage.
Right. So, in thinking about a species like a Komodo dragon, we try to understand what different ecological roles some reptiles and amphibians play. And not that every species of animal has to serve a purpose to have the right to exist or be, but in most circumstances, you can find that an ecosystem exists because or thrives because they have certain types of species there. So, can you give us a couple examples of certain reptiles or amphibians and the roles that they play in holding up an ecosystem?
Yes, that's a really great question, because the question I get asked most when I give public lectures is people say, why should we care so much? What's the value? Sea turtles are wonderful. People love to snorkel with them in Hawaii and so forth. But what's the real value of a sea turtle? Will we really be losing anything? Would the earth be affected? So I point out that at one time in Earth's history, before people, sea turtles, unfortunately for them, are tasty. Their eggs are tasty. So they've been just slaughtered globally for couple of centuries. And before that happened, sea turtles might have been, in terms of their overall weight, the biomass of their, as an aggregated group of animals, of millions of them, might have been one of the heaviest things on the planet, and one of the greatest sources of carbon storage on the planet, because they were that abundant. When you go to Hawaii today, which is the only place on Earth where sea turtles are not threatened, they're really common, they're even abundant, because because of tourists, because this is a wealthy country, America, where people are not eating them anymore, they've really rebounded in a huge way. But they represented at one time, no doubt, one of the greatest sources of meat on the planet for any other animal, marine animals that eat meat. And by the same token, many of these animals, whether it's Komodo dragons, which also scavenge, they also eat carcasses of dead animals, or many turtles that live in lakes and ponds and streams that also feed on detritus, on dead stuff, they have a pretty vital role as scavengers in ecosystems. And if they disappear, we know worldwide that vultures are disappearing rapidly because they eat carcasses of animals like cows that have often been treated with veterinary drugs that then kill the vultures, and that the loss of vultures as essential scavengers is a really bad thing for the ecosystem, for the planet, and even for the country in which the animals live. So the same is true for turtles and tortoises. So yeah, I mean, people would say, well, what's the function of a boa constrictor? Why do we need rattlesnakes? Nobody wants rattlesnakes. But they are, in fact, in the case of rattlesnakes, they're big time predators. They eat rodents. People who have rattlesnakes and gopher snakes here in Southern California living near their homes have a lower rodent population. We know that. To deal with. So, no, they have a role to play, as does most everything in an ecosystem. And then the question becomes, what's the real harm of the loss of those animals? When people want to kill every rattlesnake they can find. And then I always turn to, in addition to the ecological role, the moral responsibility, that you could say the same thing about so many living things, that they're expendable. But really, from a moral standpoint, I don't see them as expendable.
What are some of the other unnatural threats that some species are facing that we could alter as
Well,
humans?
one of the biggest threat, of course, to all wildlife on Earth is habitat destruction, habitat loss. That's kind of the elephant in the room for all forms of animals and plants. And at some level, I suppose that's dependent on human population growth, which the current projections tell us that Earth's population, which we used to think was going to continue to grow exponentially for centuries, will not. You know, birth rates are dropping worldwide rapidly. So Earth's population is going to peak and then will begin to decline, maybe even decline precipitously sometime in the coming century. So habitat loss, therefore, may not in the end take out all of the biodiversity that we worry about losing. But in the current day, in the here and now, one of the threats that I work with most and I try to prevent most in my role with the organizations that do conservation is the pet trade. You know, a lot of reptiles and amphibians are very sought after pets. Turtles and tortoises, of course, maybe not Komodo dragons so much, but many of the smaller monitor lizards are highly sought after, and people are willing to pay thousands and thousands of dollars to get one. Some of them are bred in captivity, but many of them are not. Many of them are still poached from the wild, even if they're legally protected in their home country. They're still poached. There's a thriving, quite illegal poaching trade that happens in our own United States from the southern states like Florida and the Gulf Coast, where we have lots of turtles and tortoises and snakes and lizards. And they are being sent especially to East Asia. It used to be that people in China and Indonesia and Japan and Korea, that in some of those countries there was a taste for instance, turtle meat. And that was the reason that those animals were threatened. Today, there's a lot of turtle farming and ranching that goes on in China in a sustainable way. But the pet trade has boomed and people have a lot more money to spend in those countries than they used to. So there are tortoises that incredibly will sell for $100,000 for an individual tortoise on the global black market. And this is really has a devastating impact. In fact, there are some routes across the Pacific in particular where some of the narcotic smugglers are also doing wildlife smuggling, which carries less profit, but also less risk if you're caught, less risk of going into a long prison sentence. So we deal with this a lot, and it's happening every day. As I said, the southern US and also Mexico are two of the biggest sources globally for turtles and tortoises, and some of the lizards also, and some of the snakes to be shipped out. South America has a lot of very beautiful tree frogs and arrow poison frogs that also are going into the trade. So these are not sustainable numbers, is the real problem. That once you begin vacuuming, you know, the forests and the lakes and the streams of these small animals, they can't replace themselves and we can't replace them.
Can you share with us, on a positive note, some of the conservation success stories that you've either been a part of or that you've seen in action right now?
Since I talked about sea turtles, I'll mention that sea turtles, as bad as the situation has been for them in the past, as people know, female sea turtles sometimes navigate big parts of the globe, but they come back to the beach they were hatched on to breed themselves. And so they may come back to a beach, and in the past, thousands upon thousands would emerge from the surf on a given night of the year and cover the beaches and come back from thousands of miles away to reach those beaches. But there would be poachers on the beaches who would be collecting the turtles for their meat, or especially collecting their eggs, because the eggs were a delicacy, and particularly in some countries. So that devastated those populations. And then, for instance, along the coast of Mexico and in Costa Rica, those populations were protected. About 20 years ago, protections were enacted, and they were good protections. And some of the people who had been poachers turned to become ecotour guides. So now they were taking tourists on nighttime tours of beaches to see the turtles nesting or to see the turtle eggs that are collected sometimes and put into hatcheries to see the babies released. Now some of your listeners have probably done this. And after 20 years of protection, we're just delighted that only in the past several years have we suddenly begun to see massive arrivals of females on the same beaches again, meaning give them one generation, about 20 years for many sea turtle species to reach maturity, give them one generation of sea turtle protection, you know, from harassment by people, and they do rebound. So many sea turtle populations are in terrible trouble in many parts of the world, but those that are in areas where you can find a sustainable use for them, where they can become a part of an economy that provides a livelihood to local people that doesn't involve exploiting them, you know, for their meat or their eggs, that's a pretty big success story in the making. And I hope that before we lose these species, there are seven sea turtle species, and several of them are in really terrible trouble. Before we lose them, that we can save them by making people see the economic incentive that comes from tourism.
How did you conduct all the research for your book? Were you boots on the ground in many areas?
Each chapter is a case study, and I try to provide the narrative, which is not only the biology of the animals, which is super fascinating, whether we're talking about Arapaima and frogs or Komodo dragons, but also the cultural background, because in many cases, the animals are hated by local people. People are afraid of them. They're worried that some animal is going to bite or hurt their children. So we have to deal with those issues also when we try to set up conservation programs. And as you said, there are success stories, and then there are stories that are so poignant because we haven't been able to succeed yet. So in some of those cases, yes, I was on the ground. I was either involved in the research or I was mentoring one of my graduate students to do the work, and so visited those places. And then because of my role in IUCN, International Union for the Conservation of Nature, as one of the specialist group chairs, I deal a lot with colleagues who do work with, for instance, chameleons in Madagascar and Africa. And so I write from personal experience, either the work that I've actually done or work that I've been in some way connected to.
Yes, the book is really fascinating in how you've broken it down and how you have created these pathways for us to learn more about the biology of these animals and their conservation. When you close your eyes and think of writing this book, what is one of the main images or stories that first pops up for you in your mind's eye?
Well, you know, one of the early chapters in the book is a story I've been quite involved in, which is the plowshare tortoise. That is the world's rarest tortoise, most likely, found in northwestern Madagascar. Beautiful big tortoise that reaches 50 pounds or more. And they may have been abundant in the past, but in our recent recorded history, they've always been endangered. And they are, when I mentioned earlier that some tortoises can bring $100,000 on the international black market, that's the species I was thinking of, because they are incredibly rare. And as we know, the sad kind of perverse human nature aspect of this is that as something becomes rarer and rarer, it becomes more valuable and therefore more likely to be sought after. And of course, if we're talking about a rare stamp, you know, that stamp collectors are all trying to get before their rivals get it. Okay, that happens and the stamp becomes crazy valuable. But that's not really of the same order of magnitude of moral risk, I think, that we're talking about with animals. And so as these animals become highly threatened, they become valuable. And in some countries, they even become investments, because tortoises, for instance, live a very long time. And so it's almost like buying stocks. You get a smuggled baby tortoise, you pay $20,000 for it, and 20 years later, it's worth an untold sum. So the story of the plowshares is that they're probably functionally extinct in the wild, functionally extinct meaning they still exist, but there are so few they probably can't find each other to mate. There is a fenced-in area in the forest where they used to live, fairly large, of a number of acres, under armed guard, where they are living in a kind of a wild/not wild situation, where they're in the forest, but they're fenced in so that we know where they are and they can be protected. But really the long-term future is going to be that we try to breed them in captivity. And unfortunately, they take 20 years to reach puberty, so they breed very slowly, but they do breed in captivity. We know that. And we recently had some of the first hatchings in the Western Hemisphere, here in California, actually. So we believe that we can, at least in captivity, keep these animals going. And hopefully at some time in the future, when the situation on the ground is better, and we can return those animals to the wild. And that has been done with other species, that we thought they were just gone, but they've been bred by the thousands in captivity, and now they've been released into the wild in the proper setting where they're still receiving protection, but they are living again as a wild species. So I think of plowshares being one of the really poignant cases in the reptile world of species that we would hate to lose. And so many people are trying desperately to prevent them from going extinct. And we're kind of we're just on the brink of maybe turning the corner to saving them.
Well, that's definitely good news, and we appreciate all that you do. The book is called Cold-Blooded Murder, Reptiles and Amphibians on the Brink of Extinction. We've been speaking with Professor of Biological Sciences and Anthropology at the University of Southern California, Craig Stanford. And Craig, if people wanted to learn more about you and your writings, do you have a website they can go to?
Yeah, if you just Google my name, actually, you'll pull up a lot of information about this and about the book. And if you were to look up IUCN and the Tortoise and Freshwater Turtle Specialist Group, you'll find our website, which is packed full of information and articles and photos and so forth about the situation that turtles and tortoises face in the world. And there are many other specialist groups that deal with everything from crocodiles to boas and pythons to frogs.
Well, we'll include that website on our website, kpcw.org, when we put a link up to this segment. So thank you so much. And I am softening to the Komodo dragon.
Good, good. You don't need to soften too much. Just maybe, the fear is warranted in some ways, I guess.
Yes, the fear is warranted, but I do have a deep respect for our natural world, and I do believe that all species have the right to exist, and Komodo dragons being one of them. But I appreciate you giving me so much of a background on them and helping me to understand them a little bit better. So thank you so much, Craig Stanford, for being a part of this Green Earth today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.